Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger or disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade dream list. I'm John McCoy, and with me today is co-host Jelani Sims.
Hello. Nice to be with you.
Jelani and I have been messaging about this for a while here, but this is the first time we're actually talking. So why don't you tell me and all the people out there in podcast land a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm Jelani Sims. I'm from Houston, Texas, born and raised. I went to the University of Oklahoma, where I have a bachelor's in journalism and a master's in professional writing, which is basically creative writing. I'm currently a English teacher going into my third year teaching English, 9th through 11th grade English. So that is my story in short.
The big question, do you teach Huckleberry Finn in your classes?
We actually do not get to Huckleberry Finn in our classes currently. We do learn some of the realist authors. That's 11th grade, where you do American Lit, and he's mentioned, but we don't actually get around to reading him. We read more of Ambrose Pierce and The Crucible and A Raisin in the Sun, those books.
As we've hinted, and as you know from looking at the title of the podcast, this time we're doing Mark Twain's 1884 novel, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, which,
yes,
of course, is a central book to the American canon, but a difficult book, I think, to teach on the high school level. Although I was taught this book in high school, I went to a school where it was just taught. And strangely enough, they didn't really touch on all of the very problematic, difficult issues of the book that we're going to talk about this time. Jelani, I assume you've read this book in various classes.
Yes, I first interacted with the book in high school. Unfortunately, I don't have strong memories of the content that was discussed. Actually, like you said, I don't remember some of the more intense things in the book being discussed in full detail. It was kind of something that, you know, we reviewed and moved on to the next thing. So this truly is one of those books that, like you intro'd your podcast one time, I should have paid more attention to when I was 16. Ever since high school, it's kind of sat on my bookshelf, and I haven't really touched it up until the moment when I decided it's time to revisit it and discuss with you about it, actually.
This is the first time I've read this book in... Oh, man. I was a big Twain fan when I was a teenager. I read this book in graduate school, and I thought, holy crud, this is a much more difficult book than I remember it being. And I didn't touch it again until just now. So it's been like 20 years for me, too. Huckleberry Finn gets bandied about as a central text of American literature. And it's kind of funny that it does, because at the time of publication, it wasn't necessarily seen as anything particularly outstanding.
Well, it got banned in its first year of publication, well, in 1885.
Yeah.
For being crass and coarse.
Yeah, and it is those things. It is all those things. Mm-hmm. Apparently, Louisa May Alcott was no fan, but it gained traction in the 20th century. And famously, it was Ernest Hemingway who called it the book that all of American literature flows from. That's not the exact quote.
Yeah, he said that there's nothing. Yeah, I think he said that there was nothing before that, and there was nothing after that that would be that good. Yeah,
but he also had problems with the book too. He thought that the ending of the book was a big problem. I think everyone who's read the book finds the ending to be a little bit difficult to swallow.
Yeah, that was very tough read. Like those last 11 chapters, I think, is when those scenes take place. Yeah.
While a lot of people point to this novel as sort of the beginnings of realism taking over in American literature, and that something major was going to happen. Twain himself, I don't think, really thought of this book on those same terms, because shortly after this, you know, he went back and he wrote two more Huckleberry Finn, Tom Sawyer novels that were just straight up pastiches of Jules Verne and mystery novels. It was like he just thought of this as like light entertainment.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that what Mark Twain was trying to do was just share his experience with others, because like a lot of other realist authors, he wrote directly to his experience. How Huck Finn, you know, is a pilot on the Mississippi River, you know, so it was with Twain. He was a steamboat pilot, and he learned the Mississippi like the back of his hand. And I believe it's the Duke character, correct, is a printer, like Mark Twain was a printer. And even Mark Twain's pen name, I learned, is a steamboat term that had to do with the steamboat being able to travel safely in the water, the depth of the water. So I think that was Mark Twain's goal, was definitely sharing realism and showing us what it was like to be in the South. And I think that that's one of the reasons why the book is known as the great American novel, is because it was also one of the first novels, or the first novel, to capture the colloquialisms and really relay the local color that Mark Twain lived around in his life.
Yeah, it's also informative to remember. This is published in 1884, so this is after the Civil War. Yeah. And if Tom Sawyer, the book that precedes this, which we aren't going to talk about, if that was kind of a nostalgic Americana childhood memory of what life was like in the South before the war, this is of a much more darker, more fantastical, crazy vision of America as this place full of predators and con men and danger and sudden death and all kinds of stuff.
Of which the main character is one of those con men.
Exactly. If you don't mind, I'm going to give a brief summary here. I think a lot of our readers out there are familiar with this book. It's a long book and it's very episodic. There's many passages that don't relate to one another. So I'm just going to give the barest of outlines, and we can come back and fill in more of the detail if you want to, or just talk about theme and style. The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn is the story of our hero, who's a poor and usually homeless boy of about 14, living in the antebellum world of a fictional town in Missouri called St. Petersburg, which is on the banks of the Mississippi.
Yes.
Following the previous book of Tom Sawyer, Huck found himself in the possession of a big fortune, but he has no immediate access to that, having been put in trust for him. He's also got new adoptive parents, the Widow Douglas and one Miss Watson, who try to civilize him by giving him middle-class tastes and values.
Mm-hmm. And he met them because he saved Miss Watson in the first book, I believe, in Tom Sawyer, yeah.
Into this world steps Huck's dad, who's called Paps or Pappy, who is a drunk, abusive, and destitute man who kidnaps Huck as part of a plan to get his hands on Huck's money. He takes him to live in the woods in a cabin with him. Huck initially enjoys this because he likes living a free life, but he doesn't like the fact that his dad gets roaring drunk and beats him and has deliriums in which he almost kills Huck. So he devises a plan to escape by faking his own death. He paddles out in a canoe to an island in the middle of the river, where he meets the runaway slave Jim, who used to belong to Miss Watson.
Yes.
And the two of them strike up a friendship based upon their both being outcasts. They both enjoy trading folkways with each other, which tend to be superstitious tales about the world. Huck likes Jim, but because he has such an innate sense that slaves are absolutely someone else's property, he feels ambivalent about aiding Jim in any way. And this ambivalence runs through the entire book and motivates several of the things that Huck does. The two of them head down the river after Huck discovers that people are looking for Jim. they have all these crazy adventures. They come aboard a derelict steamboat where they run into robbers, they run into bounty hunters, and eventually Huck and Jim get separated for a while when a steamboat runs down their raft, and he ends up in the middle of a interfamily feud between two families called the Grangerfords and the Shepherdsons, which is sort of like Romeo and Juliet, except that instead of the two lovers dying, everyone else dies. Huck and Jim, Huck and Jim reunite, and they're joined in their travels now by two exasperating con men called the Duke and the Dauphin, who claim to be nobility and engage in a series of flim-flams and shoddy stage plays over the longest section of the book, which culminates in a sequence of them trying to defraud the estate of a recently deceased gentleman named Wilkes by pretending to be his long-lost brothers from England. This plot ends badly for them, and Huck escapes, tries to escape the two with Jim, but the Duke and the Dauphin show up. They retaliate by selling Jim at the next stop down the river to a farm where the farmers, whose names are Silas and Sally Phelps, are going to collect the bounty on him. It turns out, however, that Silas and Sally Phelps are the uncle and aunt of Tom Sawyer, and they mistake Huck for Tom when he shows up at the farm. And then Tom himself shows up late in the book and, eager to play at fantastic rescuing games, pretends to be his own younger brother, Sid. Drawing from his own love of romantic fiction, Tom devises an unnecessarily complex plan to free Jim, who could actually probably easily escape with the boys at any time. But in the course of this ridiculous and overly elaborate escape, Tom is shot in the leg, and Jim gives up his freedom to get Tom to a doctor. It then turns out that Tom knew that Jim was actually free all along because Miss Watson had died shortly after they left and emancipated him in her will. Jim explains in another crazy deus ex machina that he had earlier seen Huck's father killed when they had walked into a house floating down the river. And so Huck is free. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the novel, Sally wants to adopt Huck, but Huck vows that he's had enough of civilization and plans to leave for the West. So that, in the barest bones, is what happens. Obviously, I've left out a lot, and what I've left out are the incredible voice that permeates this novel, which is all told first person from Huck's perspective, and a lot of very difficult and problematic sequences involving Huck's relationship to Jim and what we ultimately think of Jim's character. Is there anything you wanted to touch on that I didn't speak about that you might want to point out before we start talking about themes or things like that?
Well, actually, I wanted to start by going into, before we go into, you know, interpreting this book, I wanted to bring up the notice that Mark Twain puts at the beginning of the novel. You notice that he says, persons attempting to find motive in this narrative will be prosecuted. Persons attempting to find a moral in it will be banished. And persons attempting to find a plot in it will be shot. And so I find, and you know, Mark Twain, a lot of his work is ironic. And I find it interesting how with this notice that he has made, even our interpretation now, so many years later after his work, ironic, and the fact that we're the ones that need to be prosecuted, banished, and shot for even trying to interpret or discuss the plot or the morals of his novel.
This book was notoriously difficult for Twain to write. He started it, he put it aside, he started it up again, he put it aside over the course of many years. Mm-hmm. And I think over the course of time, it evolved from a straight sequel to what he was doing with Tom Sawyer into something more like this crazy quilt of his impressions of the entire country at the time, because this goes from Missouri down through all the way to, I think it ends up in Alabama, actually. And it, so it, it's following mm-hmm. The line of the Mississippi, and all along the way we're getting his impressions of what life was like in America. Now, and they're not good. they're not. Nobody really comes off well in this book. Huck and Jim sort of come off okay because they are seen as sort of pure of spirit in some way. They don't wish ill mm-hmm. on anyone. Although Huck is certainly, he's got a funny morality. He's perfectly happy to engage in petty larceny or to lie to get people to do what he wants them to do. He doesn't see any problem with that. He gets bent out of shape about Jim, and he also gets very upset about what he sees as injustice in the world, particularly as presented by the Duke and the Dauphin.
Mm-hmm. But it's funny because I had difficulty separating Huck from the Duke and the Dauphin during the novel, because he was a con man just as much as they were. Everything that comes out of Huck's mouth, you know, is a lie. He's always got some story, his wits about him, to get what he wants from people. And when I was looking up things about Huck and his characterization, I noticed that Mark Twain apparently actually based Huck off of one of his childhood friends who was named Tom Blankenship. And he said about Tom that he was, what did he say here? Hold on, I have it written down. He says, "In Huckleberry Finn, I drawn exactly as he was. He was ignorant, unwashed, insufficiently fed, but he had as good a heart as any ever had." And so that's how he described his childhood friend, and that's a lot of, you know, what's going on with Huck. He's uncivilized. He doesn't like to be washed. He does his own thing. He appears to be ignorant to issues of race, even though he's become such close friends with Jim, which is also an issue that a lot of people talk about in the book. So I don't view Huck as a perfect hero. I think he's more of kind of an anti-hero, a slightly reluctant hero, even though he actually goes into adventure just from some of the things that he does. He's a very complex character.
There's complexity that is, I think, intended by Twain, and then there's the complexity that we bring mm-hmm. as modern readers to the interpretation of Huck.
Definitely.
Part of the problem with Huck, of course, is I buy him very much as sort of a naive, wise fool who's able to negotiate this world of lies and deceit, and he's not pure in this world of lies and deceit. He doesn't mm-hmm. wish ill on people. He only wants to be left alone, and he has this incredible appreciation for natural beauty. There are these passages mm-hmm. when it's just him and Jim on the raft that are probably the passages that most people think of when they think of Huckleberry Finn, because they are so starkly beautiful, and because they are that romance people have of the idea that you could somehow leave the world behind, that somehow being out on a river is this neutral yeah. space where you're untouched by the bad aspects of civilization. But they're very,
yes.
those aren't most of the book. Those are very brief passages in this book.
"Sometimes we'd have that whole river all to ourselves for the longest time. Yonder was the banks and the islands across the water, and maybe a spark, which was a candle in a cabin window. And sometimes on the water you could see a spark or two, on a raft or a scow, you know. And maybe you could hear a fiddle or a song coming over from one of them crafts. It's lovely to live on a raft. We had the sky up there all speckled with stars, and we used to lay on our backs and look up at them, and discuss about whether they was made or only just happened. Jim, he allowed they was made, but I allowed they happened. I judged it would have took too long to make so many. Jim said the moon could have laid them. Well, that looks kind of reasonable, so I didn't say nothing against it, because I've seen a frog lay most as many, so of course it could be done. We used to watch the stars that fell too, and see them streak down. Jim allowed they'd got spoiled and was hove out of the nest."
Well, the river is kind of the, you know, the connective tissue of the book. And you mentioned earlier how it's episodic, and it definitely, the way Mark Twain organized it and wrote it, does remind me of the Odyssey, of point A to B to C to, you know, the classic hero story. And it's definitely more about is, but the river is a character itself. And as you said, all these beautiful passages of description and, the way, you know, they get run over by the boat, the river also does offer, some conflicts therein. So yeah.
I forgot how much river lore everyone in this book knows. Huck is 14 years old, and he knows everything about the practical matter of navigating vessels through the water. And we're talking about from canoes to steamboats to rafts to all these things. And Jim also knows everything about this. And there is a kind of a humorous way in which Huck and Jim trade all these crazy superstitions about the world. But they're also extremely shrewd. Both of them are extremely shrewd. They both go into things kind of wide open.
Did you notice how they seem to be, they're both skeptical of religion for the most part, but also very superstitious, which I found was an interesting contradiction or dichotomy between the two characters. Because while Huck will appear to, you know, be skeptical of religion, he is always doing something superstitious in order to get bad luck or worried about finding better luck. You know, they have all the snake skins, or I believe at one point, you know, he's spinning around or throwing salt over his shoulder, all sorts of things. So I thought that was a very interesting aspect of their character.
That's a good point. You know, I hadn't thought about that, but as you mentioned it to me, there's two things that suggests to me. One is Huck and Jim as well have a distrust for civilization, for culture, and it may be that they see organized religion as a trapping of civilization. But the other thing that occurs to me is that the kinds of superstitions they have are really connected closely to the natural world. They tend to be superstitions involving animals or plants or augurs in the weather and that sort of thing. And being they feel, both of them, I think, very attuned to the natural world. It seems much more close and experiential to them. You know, there's a lot of times when Huckleberry thing, there's passages in this book where Huck talks about people who've died and not really knowing what happens to people after they die, but admitting that he has no feeling for that one way or another. You know, he doesn't really, but the natural world he does have feelings for.
Yes, which is you know.
And it's funny too, because Huck and Jim are, I mean, Huck especially, Jim not so much. Jim is limited by the fact that as a fugitive slave, he can't really travel freely the way that Huck can. And this becomes a plot point that they have to work out in the book of what, how to keep Jim out of the hands of bounty hunters. And that typically limits him to being stuck on the raft when everyone else is going off and having adventures in town.
The moment where you realize that, you know, Jim is being left on the raft for hours, maybe days on end, tied up for one as a runaway slave that's been caught, it seems almost as if there's a kind of a reinforcement of the enslavement that he was trying to escape during, you know, their adventure. And also it was very comical when, what did they make him dress up as? Was it some sort of gypsy, or they painted him all blue?
I think they said he was a sick Arab.
Yes, a sick Arab, yes.
A lot of the jokes at the expense of the townsfolk that they encounter are that nobody has any real understanding of culture beyond their immediate world, but people aspire to it in a way. You know, the Duke and the Dauphin want to put on plays of Shakespeare, and there's long passages in the book that are written to be funny to people who know Shakespeare, but they're written at the expense of, you know, people who may not be exposed to Shakespeare, but still might aspire to have something, you know, artistic in their lives or something. I mean, even the Duke and the Dauphin, con men that they are upset and angry that the audience doesn't, the audience laughs during their performance of Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they said that the reason why it didn't go off well was because people didn't value it, and then they shuffled up something, the Nonsuch Show, which was supposed to be low culture.
It's interesting that everyone in this book is lying, but they're kind of lying in different ways. You know, Tom, of course, his fantasies are, he fantasizes for a world that seems to be built out of the romance novels that he's reading, which are things like Walter Scott and stuff. It's really odd for me to think that in the early 19th century, school kids in America would be reading Sir Walter Scott. I just can't even believe that that would be a thing that people would be reading.
Right.
But the funny thing is that Twain, as much of a, as much as he's credited for bringing on realism, and it's, you know, if you can contrast this to what came before, I mean, immediately before this are books like Moby Dick, or books like in the even earlier than that, you've got the Hawthorne and Washington Irving, and those are kind of supernatural stories. This is a book that that has none of that.
Yeah.
But Twain, late in his life, wrote a book on Joan of Arc that he claimed was the best thing he ever wrote, that nobody reads today because it's a terrible book, but it was a book that was like a straight up romance. And it's interesting that that was what he thought. Even Twain himself thought that that was the height of culture.
Well, you know, it's interesting because every author has their darling work, or their work that they spent the most time with, or the subject matter they cared about the most, or it just resonated with them the most. And oftentimes it's not the book that, you know, everybody acclaims them for. It's a personal pet project to the side that, you know, other people might think is not good at all.
Let's talk a little bit here more about Jim, because you've touched on this point of his being tied up. And part of the problem with those sequences are that I feel that Twain wants us to have a momentary recognition that Jim is being treated unfairly. There's passages where there's like a passage where Huck is lying to someone, pretending to be someone else, and he says that he was on a steamship where a gasket head was blown up, and the woman says, "Did anyone get hurt?" And he says, "Oh no, a couple of blacks got killed." By the way, this book uses the N-word throughout.
219 times.
Throughout. I myself am not going to use that word at all in this, and I just want to say, anyone reading this book, be wide aware of this fact, that that is one of the things that makes this book difficult too. So I just replaced that word in that quote, I want to say. So obviously it's played as a kind of a laugh line, but it's also played to show how callously these whites treat black lives. And as I believe that Twain
wants us,
which
is pertinent to today.
No, exactly. I believe that Twain wants us to recognize that, but the question is it really enough? Is Twain really doing it well enough, or is he also just kind of settling into cliches about white and black personalities? Certainly Huck is presented as kind of dumb throughout this book, but Jim is presented as dumb in a way that feels more essential to his race, at least as Twain is depicting it.
Well, I think we have to look at several different things that are going on when you're dealing with the issue of Huck and Jim. The first is Huck and his point of view. The story is from his first person perspective. And so when you're writing that, I think that Twain wanted to kind of convey accurately what Huck might have been thinking. If you're a boy in the late 1800s, you're going to refer to black people as the N-word. You're not going to think of them as anything else, as black or African American. Back then, black people were the N-word. This word this word, which means ignorant. They were uneducated. They didn't know anything, even if it was actually the white people who may have not been enlightened or didn't know anything. Even if that was the case, because you were, if you were a slave or if you were black or if you're the N-word, you didn't have that knowledge. And I think that there's several points in the novel where Huck says things like that. He says, you know, you can't really teach an N-word to do anything new. You can't really, you know, trust them to learn once they get something in their head. They're hard to educate. But really, as you touched out, Jim does have some knowledge and some wisdom and humanity beyond what Huck sees. And you mentioned the scene before where Huck was talking about nobody was killed on the boat, just, you know, a black person. There's another scene where Jim is crying over his family, and Huck is taken aback and he's surprised, and he says it seems that, you know, they have the same emotions that white people do.
Huck's slow realization of Jim's humanity is one of the things that people point to in this book about, I mean, this is a book written by a white author for a white audience, and it's trying to make a kind of a persuasive case to that audience that they should embrace the humanity of African Americans. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I find difficult about this is I certainly find those passages very moving, but what I still can't help feel is that Twain doesn't make the next step, which is to say, no, you don't just embrace their, obviously everyone has innate worth that we should respect, but beyond that, all your ideas about what black people are like are wrong. And that's what I feel like, that's the part that I feel he isn't willing to make, partly because everyone in this book is a cliche, but it's a little easier to swallow the cliches of, say, Pappy as a poor white trash drunk, because he's not, he doesn't fear for his freedom. He doesn't fear that someone's going to come along and sell him into forced labor. You know, there's a difference here. There's an inequality that makes it more difficult when Twain is having a joke at Jim's expense than it is when Twain is having a joke at Huck's expense, which he does quite frequently in the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if this takes things in a different direction, but when you mentioned the fact, I agree with you, the fact about how Mark Twain never kind of takes that leap and says, okay, Huck has these views, or you've seen these views, but now they're wrong. I was waiting for that moment, you know, since he uses the N-word so much, where maybe Huck decided to, you know, change his view, or, you know, Jim is more than just an N-word or more than just my property. And that moment does never come. And for me, the use of the N-word 219 times, and sometimes it's like every other word is the N-word. Every time there's a black person in the story, they're referred to as the N-word. I was kind of wondering if you're going past the point of suggestion where you use something just a few times to let us know that this is the way people think about them, you have to reason it out. You have to explain yourself, and he never did.
Yeah, I completely agree. Now, this is also, I think, there has been a lot of history since this time. This was never a good. This was never a good word. This was never a word that was not meant to be dismissive and hurtful and dehumanizing. Mm-hmm. But it is a word that I think even in the last 20, 30 years of my life, I have seen become a little bit more taboo, or a lot more taboo, actually. I think that, you know, you could still in the early 70s have a movie like Blazing Saddles that kind of casually uses it, or even as late as the 90s you could have Pulp Fiction, although, to be honest, at that point it was kind of like, what the hell are you doing here?
Well, I was actually about to bring up Quentin Tarantino. This is definitely the Quentin Tarantino problem. And, you know, with Tarantino, it's interesting. He does have a lot of clout with black audiences because he draws on blaxploitation films, you know, especially in the movie with Jackie Brown, which featured Pam Grier. He took in a lot of the culture, a lot of the language, and a lot of the mood that relates. And for some reason, he feels at liberty to use that word, I guess because he can get Samuel L. Jackson to say it every movie, but it's definitely that same problem. We know that the voice, the writer, is for our community, per se, or pro-black, or for black people, or doesn't have these thoughts, but it's confusing as to why they feel they get a free pass to use crass language or to discuss things that they maybe aren't as informed about.
Similarly, Twain himself was a staunch abolitionist, and he was probably about as progressive as a white person could be at that era. But mm-hmm. it was a different era, and as progressive as you could be at that time, is still kind of regressive by today's standards. And this mm-hmm. brings us to this whole final sequence of the book, which is.
Yeah.
Part of what's so difficult about this whole final sequence is it comes after the moment in the book where Huck makes an active choice that he is going to give up society's expectations about what it means to mm-hmm. be black and white. He's going to aid Jim in Jim seeking his freedom, even though he mm-hmm. actually believes by what he understands of religion that damns him. But, you know, he says, you know, yes. And that's a line that people love to quote from this book, because it is this kind of a remarkable depiction of someone who doesn't quite understand what's going on here. He's not ever going to quite get to be to the point mm-hmm. where he's progressive enough to really look at Jim and see beyond all this stuff. Mm-hmm. But then right after that, Tom shows up and it just becomes wacky hijinks. But they're wacky hijinks yes. on Tom and Huck's side. On Jim's side, he is facing being reintroduced into slavery, the possibility of being mm-hmm. sold into much more difficult manual labor, and further division from his family.
Or killed,
right, yes. exactly. There's people mm-hmm. who want to lynch him to make a example of him to the other slaves.
Well, in discussing these last scenes, I look at the whole book and everything leading up to this point, and there's one particular scene where Huck gets back on the boat with Jim, and he tries to make Jim think that the way things happened weren't the way it happened. No, I was here with you the whole time. We didn't get separated. You're foolish. And then Jim actually checks him and says, you know, all that we've been through and you're trying to play this joke on me. But Huck then says, I didn't do him no more mean tricks, and I wouldn't done that if I'd have known it would make him feel that way. And so we have Huck promising to never play pranks on Jim again, and then we get so far as to where he just mentioned before that he's willing to go to hell to free Jim. But then as soon as Tom gets there, we see Huck being pulled into playing pranks on Jim and doing all these different things to Jim when really they could have freed him immediately. And I don't know whether Twain intended it or not, but I think that he made some really interesting observations about interracial friendships, particularly between black and white people. And one of the things you have to think about, you have to be honest when you're talking about racism, all of us have some prejudices. Our society has ingrain these things into us through Jim Crow and everything we've seen through the civil rights movement and slavery. There's always an undercurrent of a prejudice and interracial friendships. There is a power structure that there technically white is higher than black or better than black. So oftentimes in those relationships, perhaps the white person will feel that perhaps they're more intelligent than the black person, not because they are flawed or, you know, overrun with prejudice, just because that's what they've been taught. They don't even realize that they've been taught these things. And Huck, he fights out of that. He starts to fight out of all of these different things. But I think what Tom represents is when the return of the return of that power structure, the return of that oppression. And I think that the reason why Huck backs down off freeing Jim is because Tom gives him a way out of that. And I think that's just the beginning of of figuring out what is happening here at this ending scene.
That you've given me a lot to think about there. It reminded me of some of the reviews I've read about Get Out, which talks mm-hmm. about the basic conflict here at the end of that movie is mm-hmm. how can you ever really trust across racial lines when the stakes right. are so high and when you can never really know when the person's going to turn on you, and it, and whether turn on you means they're going to literally sell you down the river, or whether it means they're going to go back to making assumptions, they're going to go mm-hmm. back to established power structures or not. It is interesting that it's Tom who comes back. Tom doesn't really have any moral compunction at all about helping Jim. Mm-hmm. To him, it's just a game. And yeah. part of what Tom represents is that ultimate white privilege, in that nothing really touches Tom. You know, he gets shot, which could be a life-threatening thing, but he treats it in the end as part of the game. He takes the bullet out and wears it as a charm, because to him that's great. You know, that's his romantic ideal. So yeah, I think everything you say there rings true. Now, part of what the problem I have again is, like, we can come up with explanations for what this last section suggests to us.
Right.
But it's sometimes kind of hard to believe that Twain necessarily had some of these things in mind. The tone of these last chapters is so goofy, and so, like, it's the sort of light slapstick comedy of the earlier part of the book. Now, before, for example, in the sequence where Huck came to the feuding families, that was kind of played for laughs and jokes, and then it ended up in actual horror. And Twain modulated that very well. There could have been a turn in these last chapters where Tom played this all up for laughs, and then the seriousness of what they're actually doing would come through, but it doesn't. It's sort of like... No. Everything is okay at the end, and Jim gets $40, so his life is fine now as far as they're concerned.
Yeah, and he's actually free, so there's a lot of apologies that Twain makes for those scenes, and I think that Tom getting shot is actually one of those things. Finally, Tom receives some punishment for all the folly and for nearly getting them all killed with a game. And actually, when I was reading those scenes, I thought the darkest moment and where everything kind of came to a head for me was when Tom was talking about putting the spiders and the rats and the snakes into the cell with Jim, and then having him play, and then Tom says, "Surely they'll swarm over you and have a good time." And then Jim has said, "But they'll have a good time, but what kind of time is Jim having?" And Jim is talking about the animals, but I think that in a larger frame of mind, he's talking about everything that Tom and Huck are doing to him. And he's allowed it because he's a slave and because he has to admit that white folks know better than him, which is something that Huck points out. But he is totally at the mercy of the privilege of his two friends, which honestly they are friends, because there's even before Huck meets up with Jim on the island, you know, there's a scene where Tom and Huck are going to the meeting of the robbers at the beginning, and they encounter Jim and they think to play a prank on Jim them. So they're well acquainted with Jim, and Jim is well acquainted with them. And in the Black of community, which speaking from experience of being African American, there's another notion of be careful with your white friends. You can't do everything your white friends do. They have access to privilege, which they won't get in trouble, as you know, Huck and Tom, they won't get in trouble for any of the games they're playing for trying to release Jim. As soon as their family finds out that it's them, you know, they'll be off the hook. But Jim was very nearly hanged after the whole play and having to expose himself in order to get medical attention for Tom. And so once again, Twain might not have been looking to that dynamic or that power structure of how white privilege works in an interracial relationship, but he ends up conveying it in a powerful way. And I actually ended up, and that's why I take the side of defending actually the ending scenes, because I can see so much of those dynamics in it. And the fact that Jim has to subject himself to torture and put up with games and torture just because of his status.
I agree that there's definitely ways that you can read these last passages and the entire book in the light of our current experience that make it make sense and give it some value. One of the things that though that also struck me as I was reading this book is Jim is presented as a noble African American throughout this book because he has such care for Huck. He keeps calling Huck honey, and he has a kind of a fatherly approach to him, and he puts himself out into danger for the boy's sake, especially at the end of this book where he literally gives up his freedom for their sake. And and as readers, you know, again, Twain writing as a white writer for a white readership, we're supposed to see Jim's humanity in his selflessness. And I don't want to say that selflessness isn't a good trait to have, but it is also unfortunate that that was the trait that black characters got to have that was noble. To the extent that they did not care for their own welfare, but cared for the welfare of people around them, they're considered valuable. But I wish Jim were allowed to have his own desires and his own ends a bit more in this book. I know that he shows up in the later books. I don't know to what extent he shows up in the later books, but one would like to see like a modern author write Jim's story after Huck Finn.
But I mean, the fact of the matter is that ideally we would like to see Jim with a little more autonomy, but he is in a time where he realistically wouldn't have autonomy, wouldn't be able to do his own thing, and doesn't have control over his own life or dreams or whether he sees his family, and because they have been sold away from him. So that helplessness, you know, there's almost nothing you can do with that in that time period. The story would almost have to be in a different time period, would have to be modern in order for you to, I think, have a black character with more volition.
Yeah. No, I agree. And this is one of the reasons why I think in spite of problems with this book, and I think one of the biggest problems I have with this book is the unevenness with which it's written. There are passages in here that I think are some of the greatest things that Twain has ever written. And then there are passages that go on and on and on. To be honest, I could have been done with The King and the Dauphin much earlier than you know, I kept feeling like, as I was reading this through, I was like, oh yeah, we still have this segment we have to go through. We still have this thing to go through. And this last sequence of the book might have actually worked better if it had been shorter. You mentioned that it was like 11 chapters long. It's a very long sequence.
It goes on and on and on. And there's actually a moment where they finally dig the hole and they're ready to get out. And then Tom presents all these different things that he wants them to do in order to find glory out of, you know, this escape, and they just go along with it, and it's like, man, they could have been out of there already, and we just have to sit there and wait to see what's going to happen with, you know, all of this folly that Tom has constructed. As I was reading this book, I was interested, you know, man, I need to go back and read Tom Sawyer and maybe get to know him a little bit. But after those chapters, I was less excited to get to know who Tom is.
Well, in Tom Sawyer, it's been a long time since I read that book too, but in that book, he's just presented more as kind of a lovable scamp. You know, mm-hmm. there's the famous sequence of him whitewashing the fence and convincing his friends to whitewash it for him. That's mm-hmm. That's just presented as again lightly humorous. I think this book is the dark side of Tom Sawyer. It's I'd be kind of curious to read. I sincerely doubt that the other two books are any good because they never get mm-hmm. taught, but I'd be curious to see what his characterization is like in those books because he goes so, so dark in this one. And Huck himself comments on not understanding Tom, not knowing what Tom is up to, not wishing that Tom were a little bit more sensible.
Well, Tom is almost insane, frankly. And I think that Twain did a good job with those passages of conveying some insanity with Tom, because when he was like, man, I wish it would take 90 years for us to get him out of there, and our descendants and family will have to free Jim. And he's essentially talking about keeping Jim forever, you know, enslaving Jim and his family, having him, and it's basically torture once you find out that he knew that Jim was free the whole time, you know, with some of the things that he forced him to do, etching into stone and putting rats in there. And then Twain said every time a rat bit him, then he could write in blood on the wall. And when his aunt and all the other men saw what was going on in the shed, it looked like a place of insanity, a place where something weird and wrong had happened. And he literally got his whole family into a frenzy with, you know, the animals being released in the house and the sheets and the candles disappearing. So it seemed like he wanted to sweep everyone up into kind of this delusion and this fanciful adventure that he felt he was on.
Before we wrap this up here, I do want to say one of the nice things about reading this book is reacquainting yourself with passages that you might not have remembered. And mm-hmm. in chapter 17, there is a sequence where Huck has just fallen in with the Grangerfords, one of the feuding families.
Yeah.
And he describes drawings and poems produced by one of the Grangerfords' dead daughters. And it is, to my mind, it is one of the funniest passages I've ever read. And it just really sick humor. And it is a kind of an extended pastiche on Gothic art and Gothic writing. Yeah. There's a poem that she writes, which is kind of a pastiche of Edgar Allan Poe. And it's just very, very funny. And I had completely forgotten that it existed. And so I was happy to come across that again. Did you have a favorite passage in the...
Well, actually, the passage that I thought about sharing and talking about was actually the very beginning of the book, where Huck is saying, "You don't know about me without you have read a book by the name of The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, but that ain't no matter. That book made by Mr. Mark Twain, and he told the truth mainly. There was things which he stretched, but mainly he told the truth. That is nothing. I never seen anybody but lied one time or another. Without it was Aunt Polly or the widow, or maybe Mary. Aunt Polly, Tom's Aunt Polly, she is, and Mary, the widow Douglas, is all told about in that book, which is a mostly true book with some stretchers, as I said before. And the reason why that passage stuck out to me so much is because this meta strategy that Mark Twain is using, that was also something that was very avant-garde and very forward-thinking, and something that you really saw, I remember my first time seeing that kind of thing was in the 90s, you know, when they had movies like Scream, where this is what it's like to be in a horror movies, and all the characters were self-aware. And I think that Mark Twain being able to write in that self-aware manner and do it back in 1885, I think that's what makes him a great author and one of the many reasons why this book endures.
I don't think we've solved anything about this book, but maybe we've complicated things a little bit more, and that's what we're after at the end of the day, I guess.
Well, that's probably a good thing, and I would end by encouraging everybody to revisit the book, because I think Twain still has so much to say, definitely, and so much still to say, definitely in the era of alternative facts that we're in now. Because, you know, everything that Huck says is a lie. In that beginning passage that I just read, Huck tells you that the author is prone to lies and everyone is prone to lies. And, you know, we question a lot of truths and what's on the internet. Can we believe that? Is that a tall tale? And also, which, you know, we mentioned before, Black Lives Matter movement and finding validity to Black life. And showing that, you know, people are people no matter what they look like. And Twain was working with these things way back when. It was about 20 years after the Civil War. So it is definitely a book about how post-slavery, post-oppression. This was before the Civil Rights Movement, but since we're, you know, in 2017, definitely a picture of, you know, post-Jim Crow and post a lot of things that we've seen. How do we, as Black and white people, or as, you know, just people across all different cultures, how can we relate, and what are the power structures that exist, and what are the prejudices that we have to overcome in order to work together, in order to treat each other right?
Thanks to my co-host, Jelani Sims. The reading this time was by Josh Hollis. You can hear more Josh on the Predictacast podcast. You can send email to the show at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. You can join us on the Facebook page, or you can join the discussion on the Incomparable membership Slack. We'll see you next time. And remember, everything will be on the final.